Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Joan Didion, who reads from and discusses her intensely personal new book, The Year of Magical Thinking, published by Knopf. Tonight's podcast will be hosted by author Sarah Davidson, a longtime friend of Joan Didion's, and was recorded courtesy of Boulder radio station KGNU. In the weeks to come, we have Andrew Weil, Lynn Truss, Blair Underwood, Chris Elliott, Elliot Perlman, Frank McCourt, Joseph Ellis, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Thank you all for coming. I met Joan Didion in 1971. I had read Slouching Toward Bethlehem, which was her first collection of essays, and it was one of the greatest moments in my life of reading literature. This was a totally original voice. I'd never heard anything like it. She wrote about her inner life, and I recognized what she said as true for me as well, only I didn't know it until she wrote it. I couldn't have articulated it for myself, and I thought, if she knows this, this private, almost unspoken part of myself, she must know everything. And I thought, if I can just meet her and ask the right questions and stay around long enough that I would learn everything that I needed to know about life and writing, I was 26. A friend gave me her phone number and said I should call her when I was next in Los Angeles, and she might have read one of my articles. And so I screwed up my courage and called the number, and her husband, John Dunn, answered the phone. Joan did not answer the phone in those days.
Oh, well, I hardly do now.
And I said, may I please speak to Joan Didion? And John said, who's calling? And I said my name and then kind of blurted, I just want to tell her how much I love her writing. And there was this long silence. And then Joan came on the phone and said, would you like to come to dinner? She's a wonderful cook. She makes delicious, elegant, comfort food. She made something called Mexican chicken I could still taste. Do you still make it?
Oh, yeah, I make all the time.
And John would serve drinks, and after dinner, we'd sit around this roaring fire at their house in Malibu and tell stories and joke and laugh and talk about books. And at one point, their six-year-old daughter, Quintana, who looked like a little blonde angel, came padding out in her nightgown and slippers to say hello to the guests and kiss her parents goodnight. And I could tell by the way Joan and John looked at her, at the look in their eyes, how much delight they took in this little girl. In following years, Joan wrote Play As It Lays, The White Album, a total of 5 novels and 8 works of nonfiction. Almost every writer I know who has read her, every journalist I know who has read her, has been influenced by her. Kind of the way so many who read Hemingway fell under the spell of his sentences and rhythms. And John Donne wrote 8 books, also acclaimed. Together they wrote movies like A Star Is Born and Up Close and Personal. At the end of 2003, John Donne died of a heart attack at the dinner table while their only child, Quintana, was unconscious in the ICU. This new book, The Year of Magical Thinking, is about what Joan went through in that year after her husband of 40 years died. It is being called the Book of the Year. It has been nominated already for a National Book Award. But shortly before the book arrived in the stores, Quintana died of pancreatitis. Now, Joan could have canceled this book tour, but she was raised with the Western pioneer ethic that you have to keep moving on. It hasn't been easy. Please join me in welcoming Joan Didion of Colorado. You write in the book that you cried behind your dark glasses when you were getting married.
I cried. I was terribly afraid, you know, the gravity of it. Also, there was something about the presence of my mother and father that always, or particularly my father, that always made me really cry, you know. And here was something where he had a role, you know. I mean, it was very emotional. Also, you know, you're never sure you're doing the right thing.
Now, you both wrote at home pretty much your entire marriage, but you were acclaimed for your writing before he was. Did that cause tension?
No, it never caused any tension. The first thing of mine that actually received a lot of attention was Play It As It Lays, which was 1970. So we were married in 64. So we were pretty much used to each other by the time that happened.
You know, as marriage go, it seemed that you had an extraordinary one. Did it seem that way to you too?
It certainly seemed good to me. I couldn't think of any other way of life. I don't mean that it was a default marriage, but it was. I could not imagine any living in any other situation. I mean, obviously, that was one reason that it was very hard for me to accept that he had died, you know.
Mm-hmm. He shielded you from the world. He'd answered the phone. He finished your sentences. And
he was very, very protective. And would, you know, if I got a bad review, he took it quite personally, you know. Well, as I took it kind of personally, if he got a bad review, too.
Do you think this ability to form this kind of partnership is luck or will, or is it some genetic predisposition?
Because I think it's will. I think marriages that work because you want them to work. In our case, we both came from families that in which divorce was fairly rare in our generation.
And yet in one of your first famous pieces in Life magazine, you said you were in Hawaii instead of filing for divorce.
Well, you're always doing something instead of filing for divorce. I mean, it's not, you know, I mean, obviously you get mad, you have fights, you don't speak for a couple of days. Sometimes a whole season, you know, can go by. But if you get past that, you find ways around those things. We found a way at some point after about 10 years, a way that was kind of helpful, which was, I feel as if I'm doing marriage counseling. This was what it was. If we were fighting and somebody said something unforgivable, all that person had to say was, that came out wrong. And the other person was supposed to accept it. And in fact, it worked.
Now, I knew that John had a heart condition. His father had died of heart disease, but I didn't think he would leave when he did. I was shocked.
You mean you didn't think he would die when he did?
Yeah.
Neither did I. He'd had an angioplasty in 1987. That was the first thing. He'd had a valve replaced, an aortic valve replaced in the early 90s. He had had a series of other interventions for arrhythmia over the years. But no, I thought they had fixed everything. I mean, I thought they were on top of it. And I'm not saying that as anything about the doctors. I just had this totally misunderstanding about the extent of, you know, one of the things you learn as you get older, which I hadn't learned in relation to heart disease, is that everything, every little hurt you have, every time you scrape your knee as a child, eventually you're going to have a little scar there, or you're going to have, or if you fall down, if you get break something, you're going to have a little arthritis there. Well, your heart is the same way. I mean, you're not going to have all those things wrong with it without doing some damage along the way.
How was the grief that you experienced different from what you thought about grief before it hit you?
I went crazy. That was what was totally unexpected to me. You know, I had trouble in a lot of ways, accepting it or not denying it. I was physiologically and emotionally deranged for a period of time. Now nobody noticed this, because and actually I was sort of, everybody kept talking about how brave she is because I was appeared to be getting along, making decisions, taking care of, you know, going to the hospital to see Quintana, et cetera. I appeared to be pretty much in charge, but I was not.
Yeah, they called you a cool customer.
Yes.
And your response, which was what you often did, was to go to literature to look for answers and enlightenment. What did you find?
I found practically nothing. I found a lot of books on grief, and a lot of them were written by professionals. But they talked about things like pretty obvious things like don't drink too much, don't spend the insurance money redecorating the living room. These weren't really things you couldn't think of yourself, you know. And they didn't touch the actual situation, which was much graver. And the other things, you know, then there were books by people who had themselves undergone grief, and I didn't find them very satisfactory either, because mostly they had written about it much later after they were looking back from a fairly tranquil, resolved place.
So was that what prompted you to write this book?
No, I started writing the book. I didn't realize I was writing the book. I was typing notes. I'd made a lot of notes when Quintana was in the hospital. And at some point after she got out of the hospital, I thought it would be a good idea to type them because she was still doing neuro rehab. And all of these things that doctors had said to me over the years, and the names of the doctors and the telephone numbers of the doctors, I had a sense might come in, I might need them. And then I found that while I was sitting around the hospitals, I'd made a lot of notes, too, about what I was thinking about John's death. So I started typing those along with it. And then after about 3 days of typing, I realized that I was thinking about how to structure it, which for a writer means that he or she is thinking of it as a book. And after about 4 days, I figured out a way to structure it, and so then I started writing. I was doing it basically as a way of explaining the whole thing to myself.
You wrote it extremely fast, in 3 months.
I started it at the beginning of October, and I ended it the day after New Year, or the day after. Yeah, the 31st, I guess.
You said it was like automatic writing. What does that mean to you?
Well, usually when I write something, it takes me most of the day to figure out what I want to say, and so then I get about 3 sentences written, you know, about 6 o'clock. But this was fairly straightforward. I didn't have to look for it. It was very accessible to me. It was right there in my mind, right in the front of my mind at all times. So I just wrote it. I just wrote down exactly what was on my mind. So it was really important to me. I wanted to do it. I wanted to finish it at the end of the first year, because I had a sense that it would get a little more remote after that. And I thought if there was going to be any value in it, it had to be that raw experience.
The rawness.
Mm.
And yet there is a formal pattern. There's a lot of repetitions, which is...
Well, that was the structure.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, even repetitions, which is characteristic of your style, of phrases and sentences and words, it almost...
But you notice there aren't any transitions. There are repetitions, but no transitions, which is a lot easier. Faster.
I always thought those incantations were, they became like an incantation when the phrase recurred again and again, or a motif.
Yeah, well, it gathers it gives you narrative. I mean, because it picks up meaning. I mean, the narrative is in the repetition.
One of your most famous lines is that writers are always selling somebody out. Did you sell anyone out in this book?
No, I never meant that anyway. I didn't mean it in the sense in which I had, in the sense in which people understood it.
How did people understand it?
They understood it to mean I was going in there with the long knives out, right? But that isn't really what I meant. I meant that if you're writing about somebody who's not a public figure, they are going to feel, and even no matter how what you say about them, no matter how much you admire or like them, and how much what you write reflects that, they are not going to see, they don't see themselves in exactly the same way because they aren't used to being written about. And they're going to feel a little exposed or betrayed. And that's just part of the given. It's not true of public figures because they're used to being written about. But if you go in and write about a real person, a civilian, that's they're going to feel as if you shouldn't have done that, no matter what you say.
Right. I have lost at least one friend with every book, and a good friend, a friend I cared about, and I thought I was writing a Valentine, and they find one detail.
Yeah, exactly. I was just reading this piece in this week's New Yorker about the friendship between Cézanne and Zola came to an end. They had grown up together as children in Aix. They had moved to Paris together. They had been inseparable for most of their lives, but it came to grief over something that when Zola wrote a book about the Impressionists.
So have you made peace with this? That this is the given of writing about people who are...
Yeah, I think I have. I don't like it. I mean, but there it is. I did a piece in the 90s about the aerospace business. It was kind of the decline of the aerospace business and what it was doing to one community in around Los Angeles.
Where the Spur Posse
arose. that was my way into the piece, was the Spur Posse.
For those of us who weren't around then.
This was this little story, this dumb little high school story that for some reason ended up on all the daytime talk shows, Montel and Jenny Jones, and these boys had been accused by girls in the high school of keeping score. Well, as if there was something new about boys keeping score, right? But it caused this great flurry, and there were, you know, there were correct thinking rallies at the school, and so it was a way in. So when I didn't know where the town was called Lakewood, and I kept describing it as a suburb of Los Angeles, and I'd never heard of it in 24 years in Los Angeles. So I looked in the Thomas map book, and lo and behold, there it was. It had a Douglas plant. And suddenly I saw that this was a way into the defense town. So I went and did the piece. Now, there was a sense in which I talked to a lot of people in town, and I talked to them about the Spur Posse, and I also talked to them about what was happening in the defense thing. But they thought I was mainly interested in the Spur Posse, naturally, because that's why people came. And I felt a little as if they were going to be a little disappointed when it turned out I was talking about the Rockwell plant, you know, or the Douglas plant, or. But I don't know. Yes and no. You don't come to terms really with it.
Yeah, it still always hurts.
Mm-hmm.
People often ask me, how do you have the courage to expose yourself in print?
Well, I'm a writer. It's you and it's not you. But to the extent that it is you, everything you write is you. I mean, when they ask you that question, they're usually asking that question about something that's fairly personal. But in fact, something that's not personal is just as much an exposure and just as much you.
You also often say that you write to find out what you think, and then when you find out what you think, you hide it.
Yeah.
Okay, why do you hide it?
So that I won't be so exposed. It's a temperamental wish to hide. And there is hiding even in this book where I determined not to hide. The hiding in this book it's because what happens is the basic scenes, like John dying, are repeated over and over again, and each time there is new information. So you have to withhold the information the first time, and the second time, and the third time. I mean, it's just a narrative device.
Would you read us an excerpt now from Year of Magical Thinking?
Yes. Grief, when it comes, is nothing we expect it to be. It was not what I felt when my parents died. My father died a few days short of his 85th birthday, and my mother a month short of her 91st, both after some years of increasing debility. What I felt in each instance was sadness, loneliness, regret for time gone by, for things unsaid, for my inability to share or even in any real way to acknowledge at the end the pain and helplessness and physical humiliation they each endured. I understood the inevitability of each of their deaths. I'd been expecting, dreading, anticipating those deaths all my life. They remain, when they did occur, distanced and removed from the ongoing dailiness of life. After my mother died, I received a letter from a friend in Chicago, a former Mary Knoll priest, who precisely intuited what I felt. The death of a parent, he wrote, quote, despite our preparation, dislodges things deep in us, sets off reactions that surprise us, cuts free memories and feelings that we had thought gone to ground long ago. We might, in that indeterminate period they call mourning, be in a submarine, silent on the ocean bed, aware of the depth charges, now near and now far, buffeting us with recollection. My mother was dead, my father was dead. I would need for a while to watch for mines, but I would still get up in the morning and send out the laundry. I would still plan a menu for Easter lunch. I would still remember to renew my passport. Grief is different. Grief has no distance. Grief comes in waves, paroxysms, sudden apprehensions that weaken the knees and blind the eyes and obliterate the dailiness of life. Virtually everyone who has ever experienced grief mentions this phenomenon of waves. Eric Lindemann, who was chief of psychiatry at Massachusetts General Hospital in the 1940s and interviewed many family members of those killed in the 1942 Coconut Grove fire, defined the phenomenon with absolute specificity in a famous 1944 study. Quote, sensations of somatic distress occurring in waves lasting from 20 minutes to an hour, a feeling of tightness in the throat, choking with shortness of breath, need for sighing, an empty feeling in the abdomen, lack of muscular power, an intense subjective distress described as tension or mental pain. Such waves began for me on the morning of December 31st, 2003, 7 or 8 hours after the fact, when I woke alone in the apartment. I do not remember crying the night before. I had entered at the moment it happened a kind of shock in which the only thought I allowed myself was that there must be certain things I needed to do. There had been certain things I needed to do while the ambulance crew was in the living room. I needed, for example, to get a copy of John's medical summary so I could take it with me to the hospital. I had needed, for example, to bank the fire because I would be leaving it. There had been certain things I needed to do at the hospital. I had needed, for example, to stand in the paperwork line. I had needed, for example, to focus on the bed with telemetry he would need for a transfer to Columbia Presbyterian. Once I got back from the hospital, there had again been certain things I needed to do. I could not identify all of those things, but I did know one of them. I needed, before I did anything else, to tell John's brother, Nick. It had seemed too late in the evening to call their older brother, Dick, on Cape Cod. He went to bed early. His health had not been good. But I needed to tell Nick. I did not plan how to do this. I just sat on the bed and picked up the phone and dialed the number of his house in Connecticut. He answered. I told him. After I put down the phone in what I can only describe as a new neural pattern of dialing numbers and saying the words, I picked it up again. I could not call Quintana. She was still where we had left her a few hours before, unconscious in the ICU. But I could call Jerry, her husband of 5 months, and I could call my brother Jim, who would be at his house in Pebble Beach. Jerry said he would come over. I said there was no need to come over. I was fine. Jim said he would get a flight. I said there was no need to think about a flight. We would talk in the morning. I was trying to think what to do next when the phone rang. It was John's and my agent, Lynn Nesbitt. It was not clear to me at the time how she knew, but she did, and she was calling from a taxi on her way to our apartment. At one level, I was relieved. Lynn knew how to manage things. Lynn would know what it was that I was supposed to be doing. And at another, I was bewildered. How could I deal at this moment with company? What would we do? Would we sit in the living room with the syringes and the EKG electrodes and the blood still on the floor? Should I rekindle what was left of the fire? Would we have a drink? Would she have eaten? Had I eaten? The instant in which I asked myself whether I had eaten was the first intimation of what was to come. If I thought of food, I learned that night, I would throw up. Lynn arrived. We sat in the part of the living room where the blood and the electrodes and the syringes were not. I remember thinking as I was talking to Lynn that the blood must have come from the fall. He had fallen on his face. I had noticed in the emergency room that there was a chip on a tooth. The tooth could have cut the inside of his mouth. Lynn picked up the phone and said that she was calling Christopher. This was another bewilderment. The Christopher I knew best was Christopher Dickey, but he was in either Paris or Dubai. And in any case, Lynn would have said Chris, not Christopher. I found my mind veering to the autopsy. It could be happening as I sat there. Then I realized that the Christopher to whom Lynn was talking was Christopher Lehmanhaupt, who was the chief obituary writer for the New York Times. I remember a sense of shock. I wanted to say not yet, but my mouth had gone dry. I could deal with autopsy, but the notion of obituary had not occurred to me. Obituary, unlike autopsy, which was between me and John in the hospital, meant that it had happened. I found myself wondering with no sense of illogic if it had also happened in Los Angeles. I was trying to work out what time it had been when he died and whether it was that time yet in Los Angeles. Was there time to go back? Could we have a different ending on Pacific time? I recall being seized by a pressing need not to let anyone at the Los Angeles Times know what had happened by reading it in the New York Times. I called our closest friend at the Los Angeles Times. I have no memory of what Lynn and I did then. I remember her saying that she would stay the night, but I said no, I would be fine alone, and I was. Until the morning, when only half awake, I tried to think why I was alone in the bed. There was a leaden feeling. It was the same leaden feeling with which I woke. On mornings after John and I had fought, had we had a fight? What about? How had it started? How could we fix it if I could not remember how it started? Then I remembered. For several weeks, that would be the way I woke to the day. I see now that my insistence on spending that first night alone was more complicated than it seemed, a primitive instinct. Of course I knew John was dead. Of course I had already delivered the definitive news to his brother and to my brother and to Quintana's husband. The New York Times knew. The Los Angeles Times knew. Yet I was myself in no way prepared to accept this news as final. There was a level on which I believed that what had happened remained reversible. That was why I needed to be alone. After that first night, I would not be alone for weeks. Jim and his wife, Gloria, would fly in from California the next day. Nick would come back to town. John's nephew, Tony, and his wife would come down from Connecticut. Jose would not go to Las Vegas. Our assistant, Sharon, would come back from skiing. There would never not be people in the house. But I needed that first night to be alone. I needed to be alone so that he could come back. This was the beginning of my year of magical thinking.
We're going to take some questions now that some of you have written down on cards. The first one is, how do you view memory in the writer? Is it really an unreliable agent? Or is what we remember inaccurately real?
Well, I think both those things. But I mean, memory is not, your memory of a situation is very, or of something is very often not correct, but it is correct on a deeper level. If you're writing a piece, you have to not trust that deeper level, I'm afraid.
If you're writing a piece that purports to be factual.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But if you're writing memoir, which means memory, what is most important?
Well, I always thought that Lillian Hellman got a really bad rap on Panameno. I mean, she said exactly what it was. It was stories covered over. And that was the title, Panameno. Panamendi is tracings over the existing tracing. Yes, it was true to her. Whether it was false to someone else.
Right. Second question from Elizabeth. I read a wonderful, touching review of your book in the Miami Herald recently. I wonder, do you read your reviews?
I haven't seen that review, but yes, I do read reviews. I think you have to know what's out there. I mean, a lot of my reviews are bad reviews, and you kind of have to know if you have an enemy out there. It's kind of like watching for snakes, you know. I mean, I happened to be reading a column on the op-ed page of the New York Times yesterday, and I discovered an enemy I didn't know I had.
Another question. Thank you so much for being here. I admire your work very much. I would like to ask a question about the last sentence of your book, "No eye is on the sparrow." But John did tell me that. This sentence struck me as somewhat unusual in its rhythm, given its use earlier in the book in a discussion of your faith in geology, and given its biblical connotations. I was wondering how you came to this sentence.
I think I was rejecting the idea. I came to it by way of wanting to make perfectly clear that I had not reached a resolution. The year I'd gone through had not caused me to find God in a way I hadn't found him before. I still did not believe that God was taking a personal interest in my loss. Earlier in the book, I'd been talking about, I think I'd used it earlier in the book too. I mean, mm-hmm. in some way, yeah. I was talking about my lack of faith. Mm-hmm.
So you've never had intimations of an afterlife or a greater power?
I do have a greater power. I mean, as I say, I really have a lot of faith in geology.
Which could you define that?
Well, I mean, it's, you know,
how do
I
you
mean,
worship geology?
Well, I mean, it's not anything I worship. I just recognize it. I get it. And it's certainly a greater power. There's something very, very thrilling to me about geological events. My grandfather was a geologist. That's probably why this came to me.
You sometimes said that you believe certain religious symbols or stories have a poetic truth, not a literal truth. Could you give an example of that?
Well, the whole idea of Christianity is basically seems to me to have a deep poetic truth, but it does not, for me, have a literal truth.
Another question. Are you enraged by recent political events, or has the grief in your private life overwhelmed your interest in what's going on in the world?
No, it hasn't overwhelmed my interest, but it has overwhelmed my attention span, so that I actually wrote a political piece just before I wrote this book, and I found that I had to go back through an entire two seasons because I had been paying no attention. The entire time I was at UCLA Medical Center with Quintana, for example, I had read the New York Times every morning, yes. I'd read the Los Angeles Times every morning, yes. But in the Los Angeles Times, I looked for the weather, and in the New York Times, I went straight to the crossword puzzle. I mean, I really did not read the news, so I'll have to do that again.
The part of the question, though, I think he was getting at was, a lot of people feel that we're living in the worst of times of our lifetimes.
I think we've lived in some pretty bad times before. I don't know if they're the worst of times, but there's certainly... one thing that's sort of amazing to me is how badly things can be messed up without real consequence to the messers up, to the messer uppers.
Give us one example of that one would think, why isn't the house falling down here?
Yeah, I mean, well, of course, I mean, it's sort of discouraging. I mean, the discouraging thing is that given the situation in Iraq, if we had a draft, the house would be falling down.
This book has already sold more copies in hardcover, I think, than any of your previous books. Did that surprise you?
Yes, it did surprise me. I'm glad it did.
You're glad it surprised you, or that it's selling?
No, I'm glad that it's selling.
But this extraordinary success came out of the most wretched losses. Isn't that complex?
You mean emotionally complex?
Yeah.
Not really. The losses are over here, and the success of the book is over here. If I'm going to write a book, I like for it to sell copies. For one thing, it makes it easier to get a contract on another book. So that's over here, and the deaths are over there. You keep on doing things even when people die.
It just strikes me of how John would have...
John would have been really happy. He would have been beside himself.
And this was the first book of yours that he didn't read and edit.
That's right.
Did that make you nervous?
It didn't make me as nervous as this book. This book, I felt as if I was having a conversation with him all through the book. Which is one reason I did not really want to finish it. I mean, I would consciously... When I went over the pages in the evening, I was consciously thinking of how he would read them. It was harder. As I said, I wrote a political piece before I wrote this book. And it was actually the first thing I wrote after he died. And that was very hard to... That was harder to let go without him reading it because I didn't feel on safe ground, you know.
But... It seems that the writing is just as fine, if not finer than anything you've done before. So do you wonder if his editing was really made changes in the work, or whether it was more a psychological?
No. He made changes, but he taught me how to do them myself too. You know, he'd been editing me for 40 years, so I'm a slow study, but not that slow. You know?
Thank you. And the last question I wanted to put to you is, the tragedies in your family seem almost to belong to the culture now, kind of like the Kennedy assassination. We all have that image embedded in our minds of Jackie in black and little John saluting. Does it feel like something very private has become public?
No, it's still private to me. It's still private to me. Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming. For being
Thank
here.
You, Sarah.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattercover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Andrew Weil, Lynn Truss, Blair Underwood, Chris Elliott, Elliot Perlman, Frank McCourt, Joseph Ellis, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on November 7th, 2005.